We might not be able to. I don't know.
Can anybody see that? So maybe I'll just read it. Or if you guys have it pulled up on your phones, we can, whoever has a phone, we can share with each other and do like that. Pitwa paha, pitwa papa da papa bir. Asananatmamurtaya. Prakshamas tapasa shanta. Yata kamanu sevaya. Pitwa papa da papa bir. Asananatmamurtaya. Prakshamas tapasa shanta. Yata kamanu sevaya. Pitwa papa da papa bir. Asananatmamurtaya. Prakshamastapasa shanta. Yata kamanu sevaya. Please chant. Pitva papada papadvi. The word for word. Pitva. Having drunk. Apaha. Water. Pada paha. The trees. Padbhi. With their feet. Asan. Assumed. Nana. Various. Atma murtayaha. Bodily features. Prak. Previously. Kshamaha. Emaciated. Tapasa. By austerities. Shantaha. Fatigued. Yata. As. Kama anusevaya. By enjoying acquired desired objects. And the translation and purport by the servants of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. The trees had grown thin and dry, but after they drank the newly fallen rainwater through their feet, their various bodily features blossomed. Similarly, one whose body has grown thin and weak from austerity again exhibits his healthy bodily features upon enjoying the material objects gained through that austerity. Purport. The word pada means foot and pa means drinking. Trees are called padapa because they drink through their roots, which are likened to feet. Upon drinking the newly fallen rainwater, the trees in Vrindavan began to manifest new leaves, sprouts, and blossoms, and they thus enjoyed new growth. Similarly, materialistic persons often perform severe austerities to acquire the object of their desire. For example, politicians in America undergo grueling austerities while traveling about the countryside campaigning for election. Businessmen also will often deny personal comfort to make their business successful. Such austere persons, upon acquiring the fruits of their austerity, again become healthy and satisfied, like trees eagerly drinking rainwater after enduring the austerity of a dry, hot summer. Om Gyana Timinandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militangena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Utapada Kamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavam Shcha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakan Vitamscha Hey Krishna Karuna Sindha Dina Bandha Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Rishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Mukham Karoti Vachalam Pangum Langayate Ginim Yat Kripam Tamaham Vande Shri Gurum Dinataranam Namaum Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadhara Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So I'll just reread the translation. The trees had grown thin and dry, but after they drank the newly fallen rainwater through their feet, their various bodily features blossomed. Similarly, one whose body has grown thin and weak from austerity again exhibits his healthy bodily features upon enjoying the material objects gained through that austerity. So this chapter is very interesting because it gives these metaphors not only in a devotional context, but also to teach about the ways of the world. We hear about one thing that sticks to mind is farmers, they reap the benefits in the fall time of harvest after the rainy season. And all of the people who think they're sophisticated and don't want to do any farming, don't want to cultivate the land, they're cursing themselves, oh, why am I not reaping any benefits now? This farmer, he's so rich at this time. He has so much payoff from his farming. And I'm so stupid. I didn't plant anything because I thought, oh, he's just a simple farmer. Look how hard he's working. And so in the same way, materialistic people, they don't put in the effort. And then when they see efforts pay off that they previously were disregarding, they curse themselves. And so here, we're specifically hearing about some of our acharyas comment that this verse is about yogis. It's about tapasvis. And so they do long austerities. They wade and wade. And we hear about them sitting on mountains for thousands of years and slowly reducing their eating to the point of just leaves and then just air and then not even breathing anymore, just suspending the life airs. And ultimately, they're waiting for a material payoff. They're waiting for some siddhi. They're waiting even liberation. We can say to some degree because it's a material desire. They're waiting for some payoff. And so these rains and these trees drinking these rains, these padapas who drink through their roots, they're getting the payoff of all of their austerities in the form of the rainy season. So in the same way, the yogis, they wait and they wait and they wait. They do their austerities. And then they get their payoff. They get the fulfillment of the ability to gratify their senses to a much higher level than they could before. And we hear about this a few times in the Bhagavatam, and many, many times people do austerities to get, again, yogic perfections. They do austerities to go to higher realms in the material realm so that they can enjoy more and more and more. And so that's what this verse is particularly pointing out, this kind of cycle of austerity and enjoyment. Austerity and enjoyment. austerity and enjoyment. And in the purport that the disciples of Srila Prabhupada have written, they've also highlighted how this happens in the regular world. That businessmen, or we can say, in my experience, college students, people all over, they go through so much grueling austerity in an effort to find a secure place in the world, in an effort to find a place from which they can comfortably enjoy. We hear about people opening 3 businesses at once, or so many, any number of things, crazy things. College students eat ramen for 4 years, you know, so that they can afford to go to the really, really, really prestigious school that they're in the hopes that they're going to land somewhere that is comfortable, where they can live their dreams from. I was in New York City for 3 years, and the air of New York City is that everyone that is there is undergoing the austerity that they're undergoing in the hopes of making it. A small number of people have made it, and they live in the apartments right around Central Park, and they're doing really, really well. They're making 500K a year, 700K a year. They can afford to spend $15,000 a month on a new apartment, and every year switch just for the prestige of, you know, now I'm on the north side of Central Park. Last year I was on the west side, you know. But everybody else, the 99%, especially the people in Manhattan, they're living in a $3,000 a month, a studio, one room apartment, with the hopes that they're going to score and make it. They're doing all this austerity through the year, through the summer, and they're hoping that, oh, when are the rains going to come? When are the rains going to come? It's going to fall on me, and then they can make it. And the result of this is mostly it's dashed, because the 1% is, that number doesn't grow so much. The people who are successful, the people who make it. Just like with the yogis, the ones who are successful, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, it's a very, very difficult process. Not so many people are successful at this austerity and at making it. Actually, because there are many, many obstacles that are placed in the way, just like in material life, of somebody who tries to be successful by their own means. Yogis actually, and people who strive for self-realization by their own endeavor, they're often met with many, many external forces coming against them. For one, they have to control their mind on their own. It's their own volition that is going to keep their mind in check, and it's their own volition that is going to keep them from spending the energy that they're trying to withhold and grow, so that ultimately they can spend it the way they want to spend it. But also, externally speaking, the demigods like Indra and Varuna and, you know, the entire pantheon of demigods, they're not so happy when somebody strives for yogic cities and self-realization. And so they also put obstacles in the way of these people. This is actually one of the principal differences between the, I don't know about principal differences, but it's a big difference between the practice of bhakti sadhana and gyan sadhana, is that for somebody who practices gyan, somebody who practices yoga, the demigods, they're a little bit afraid, because they know this person has some selfish intention. And if you get powerful enough in your sadhana, so to speak, and you amass enough energy, you can usurp them from their position. We see Indra wasn't so happy. Indra wasn't so happy with Yudhishthira. Even though Yudhishthira was a bhakta, he was acting on the platform of a king, and so he was carrying out dharma. He wasn't so happy with the 100 horse sacrifices of Yudhishthira. Or Prithu Maharaj, he actually got in the way of. So with Prithu Maharaj, Indra, he was afraid that if he does 100 horse sacrifices, he'll be qualified to actually kick me out of my position. And so he went, and he screwed up the sacrifices, 97, 98. And finally, Prithu Maharaj gave up, because he was a devotee, so he understood that anyway, this isn't important. I don't need to do this. And similarly, we see Vishvamitra, a yogi. He was meditating for thousands of years because of his desire, as Chandrapali Maharaj was telling us the other day, to get the power of a brahmana, Because he met Vashishtha Muni and he thought, what is the point of me being a king? Because he was a great Kshatriya. He thought, why be a king? If this Muni, he has a cow who can just obliterate all my soldiers, obliterate everything I have. The real power is with the Brahmanas. And so he sat down to do austerity to become a Brahmarshi. And in his endeavor to become a Brahmarshi, the demigods became a little afraid. They thought, oh no, he's becoming powerful. He could take one of our positions. If he gets powerful enough, he can decide, I want what you have. And then he can have it, because that tejas is like the currency of the higher realms. And so they started to send him, quote-unquote, boons. They said, okay, you've done really well, we're pleased with you, you can become a Rajarshi. And Vishvamitra said, no, I'm okay. I'm going to sit here, I'm just going to keep breathing. I'm going to keep doing austerities. I don't want to be a Rajarshi, that's not big enough. I want to be a Brahmarshi. And so the demigods say, oh no, he didn't go for it. They always go for it, they go for the trap. But this Vishvamitra, he's intelligent. So then they thought, how can we stop him? How can we stop him? What can we do? So then we hear this story that Indra sent Menaka. Was it Menaka? I believe, yeah. There are a couple really, really beautiful apsaras. There are many, but there are a couple principal apsaras in heaven that are the most beautiful women that can be imagined in the material realm. And so Menaka was the most beautiful of all of them. And so Indra sent Menaka to Vishvamitra to bewilder him. And just by the tinkling of her ankle bells, Vishvamitra's meditation was disturbed. And then he saw her, and then they had conjugal affairs, and then everything's gone. And he thought afterwards, after he enjoyed, no, I've wasted everything. Thousands of years of austerity, completely wasted. Why? Because the demigods, they're not happy when one who still has some selfish tinge of motive starts to climb this ladder. And so they put any number of obstacles. At the end of the day, he sat down and he did more, and he eventually became a Brahmarshi. But the path was rife with struggle, as Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, that the path is troublesome. It's just troublesome in and out. There's nothing but trouble for those who try to reach self-realization or reach some level of evolution on their own means. And I thought this was interesting, because this verse kind of speaks to me in my own realization that austerity is not really the process of the bhaktas, which is something that in the beginning we kind of need. We need this idea that, okay, yes, A plus B equals C. I do this, and in that way I'm going to get this. But we learn that actually the process is much more subtle. It's not based on us restraining the senses for a particular period of time and getting some payoff, like the trees do in this verse. They wait and they wait and they wait, and then the rains come. And the yogis, they wait and they breathe and breathe, and then they stop breathing, and then payoff comes. They get what they wanted. For a bhakta, the process is quite a lot different. It's not really our process to just plug in austerities. Because we're looking to do something altogether different. The process of bhakti is actually the only path which leads one to what we can call true selflessness, and truly acting with one's body, mind, and words for the benefit and the pleasure of somebody else. That somebody else particularly being Krishna. So we hear this verse that everyone should know, because it's practically the most important verse that Rupa Goswami has given to us. It's Anyabhilashita Shunyam Jnana Karma Dhyanavritam Anukulyena Krishnanu Shilanam Bhaktir Uttama. So first, this Anukulyena Krishnanu Shilanam Bhaktir Uttama. So this Uttama Bhakti, pure Bhakti, which is the standard by which we measure things, we may not be practicing it because it's a very high thing, but we aspire towards it. Uttama Bhakti means that we only do things which are conducive to Krishna's pleasure in a favorable mood, which is very high. We do things that Krishna would like, and we do them when he would like them, so to speak. And we do them with a desire not to do it just because somebody told me to do it, but because I actually genuinely, deeply want that. So that's very, very difficult. And then the external characteristics that we hear, the first half of the verse, is this anyabhilashita shunyam. So there should be no other desire other than that. Jnana karma dhyanavritam. And jnana karma and other things like yoga, tapas, austerity, all of these things, they should not eclipse this goal of pleasing Krishna. So that's where the little curveball is there, because they can also be used. All things actually can be utilized in Krishna's service as long as this internal consciousness is there that I'm doing this because I want to please Krishna. Now, many of us, and I can say for myself, at one point or other have hung ourselves with this understanding because it can be misused in an immature way. And one can say, oh yes, I'm doing anything. We use this yukta vairagya. But if the proper detachment isn't there, then we use it with still a selfish intention. And actually just becomes lip service that, yes, Prabhu, I'm doing this because I want to please Krishna. I'm doing this because it's my propensity and it'll please Krishna. But ultimately, we're actually doing it to please ourselves. But the thing is by trying this and undergoing the process and going through it, we'll realize what our selfish motives are, and we'll start to see, by engaging in this thing, we'll start to see exactly where our motives lie, and then we'll be able to move forward in purifying those motives. Because we hear Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the first line of his instructions to us is Cheto Darpana Marjanam, that this practice, the chanting, remembering, hearing about Krishna, thinking about his qualities, this practice purifies the mind. It removes this miasmic covering, this dark, foggy, dreary covering, which stops us from seeing our real motives. Out in the regular world, and even with ourselves, but especially out in the regular world where people are much more covered over, the narrative that you generally see is that I'm suffering because the world is just coming down on me. Everything that happens to me is because the world is against me. All the people I know don't understand me. They're fighting me. If I could just have things my way, then things would work out. This is what we see. This is what we even feel. But as one does devotional service, one can see actually that I'm my own enemy. I'm the one. The things that are causing me to not be able to move forward, the things that are holding me back, they're actually things I'm holding on to. They're coming from within me. So this is anarchana vritti, as we understand it. The realization that, whoa, all the bad things, they're actually situated right in here. And anything that I'm seeing in the world that is holding me back, it's actually, generally speaking, me projecting that onto that circumstance and then blaming, because I'm not ready to admit the fact that actually I'm the one who is causing my own problems. This is very, very important. It's very important to go through. And it can be affected by this Cheta Darpana Marjanam, by hearing the Bhagavatam, by chanting Krishna's names, by trying as much as we can to undergo the process of remembering what we've heard and think about it and wonder about it and question, how can I apply this to my life? What can I do? How can I grow? How can I move forward with this understanding? Then these things can be revealed. Because actually, another interesting misconception that I held for a long time in reference to anarthana vritti, we generally look at this stage of bhakti like, okay, we see the bad things and then we get over them. And then after getting over them, we're fixed. We reach nishta. if anyone is familiar with these stages. So we see the bad things, and then when they're gone, then I can be fixed and I can practice nicely. But actually, some of our acharyas, they explain that nishta doesn't mean that the anarthas are gone. Nishta doesn't mean that, okay, I found them and I've removed them by the practice of my bhakti. Nishta actually means I've come to the point of realizing that the only way these things are going to go away, because I'm actually powerless, the only way these things are actually going to go away is if I find a way to cling on to the process of bhakti. Particularly the internal characteristics of bhakti, the swarup, siddha bhakti, which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu tells us is chanting, hearing the Bhagavatam, associating with the sadhus, living in Vrindavan, and serving the deity. Finding a way to make these things the center of my life. It doesn't have to be an artificial imposition of them being the entirety of my life, because that's, in most cases, not going to work. It isn't doable or practical. We even see, for people who live in the temple, and again, using myself as an example, I've seen myself struggle with this for, I'm ashamed to say, years at a stretch, that when the entirety of your life is devotional service, minute-wise, I mean, because it's not internally for most people, when the entirety of your life is devotional service minute-wise, then just like with anything else you're doing incessantly, you just have a tendency to shut off and just go through the motions, step by step. Okay, this is what I'm supposed to do, this is what I've been doing, this is comfortable. And this actually isn't, it's some sukriti is there, and it's always a springboard that allows one to enter their consciousness into what they're doing. But it's not bhakti proper. It's not Krishna consciousness, as Srila Prabhupada has told us we're supposed to aspire to. Krishna consciousness means I'm actively engaged in what I'm doing. And if we go through our day in such a way that it's so mechanical, and we find ourselves in a position of never actually pouring our consciousness into what we're doing, then we can stay in the same place for many, 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 many years. Maybe lifetimes, but at least years, years and years and years. But the positive side to that, because that's a little morbid, is that as soon as we pour our consciousness into this thing, the results can come very, very quickly. As soon as we actually start to think about what we're doing and why we're doing it. And even slow down, because a lot of times we have the sprint mentality in what is actually a marathon race. We have the idea that, yes, if I just make it, if I just get there, if I just keep going, eventually I'm going to reach the goal and get there and be there. But actually, because bhakti is it's a consciousness, it's a lifestyle, it's not something that is accomplished. It's something that is acquired and done and adapted to. Because bhakti is a lifestyle, it's more like a marathon. It's something that we settle into and we keep going at, we keep going at, we keep going at. It's not so much about this pendulum. Because that sprint mentality, it comes from this same place, this kind of material consciousness that, just like these trees and just like the yogis, I'm just waiting to get that result. What I'm doing right now is hard and difficult, but I know if I just do it, do it, do it, do it, do it, keep pushing the button, eventually the result is going to come. So Krishna shows us, often the hard way, most of the time the hard way, because that's what we need. It's what I needed and what I still need, that this isn't going to work. The result is going to be withheld. It's going to be withheld. It's about a marathon. It's about finding what we can do and what is actually appealing about bhakti. Because so much is appealing in this process. So much is wonderful and sweet and amazing. We have this book. We have the holy name, which as you chant the holy name, then eventually some drops of sweetness come from it. It stops being this bitter, terrible, difficult thing. I often say this. I remember when I first started chanting, I started with one round, and it was literally mentally the most painful thing I'd ever done in my life. I remember having the japa mala, and I didn't even have a bead bag. I just ordered a japa mala on the internet, and I would chant. And you know, when you start, maybe it takes 7, 10, maybe 12 minutes if you chant really slow. And I would chant. And then I would glance at the, oh my God, we're not even halfway. It's not. When is this going to be? Just one round, mind you. Oh, really? It's not 3/4 yet? Oh my God. I'm not exaggerating. This is how it was for a month. And then after a month, I thought, oh my God, okay, I have to go to 2 because that's what I said I was going to do. Now I'm going to do 2 for a month. And then it was just as painful. It was so bad. And I was thinking, how do people do 16 rounds of this? But eventually, as you chant for years and you go on and you go on and you go on, it becomes a little easier. And then one reaches a tipping point where, or Acharya Nishta knows because he really likes the holy name, you can sit down and you can maybe chant 64 rounds. And after you do that a couple times, maybe, wow, this isn't a horrible thing. This is actually nice. It's not always nice, but I've had a glimmer of the niceness. And so the sweetness starts to come out. A little taste starts to come. We read the Bhagavatam, and again, taking myself as an example, I went through about 8 cantos of the Bhagavatam with the idea that I'm going to finish this book because that's what I'm supposed to do. That's what they told me was required. So I made that my race. I need to finish this because that's going to affect what I want. And then after a certain point, I realized, wait a second, this is really, really beautiful. And then slowed down. And because of the association of some other devotees who are actually tasting this book, I was able to see that I'm doing this the wrong way. And then, when I started pouring my consciousness towards the Bhagavatam, lo and behold, some small results started to come. Because this is the process, actually. This is what Rupa Goswami tells us in the Upadeshamrita, which is the book of our movement for neophytes. As I've heard a few wonderful devotees say, it's Rupa Goswami's book for people who know nothing about bhakti. He starts by saying, control your tongue, control your belly, do all of these things. Then he elucidates what a bhakta should do and what he shouldn't do. He elucidates how he should interact with other bhaktas. And then he comes to saying what the process is. And he says that we do kirtan, we do sukirtan, so we do nice kirtan, which I won't define now, but can be broken down into many things. And then anusmritya, we think about Krishna. We remember the things that we've heard. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, in commenting on this verse, Prabhupada quotes his guru, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and he says that a neophyte devotee, one who is in the very beginning stages of bhakti, he should constantly hear Harikatha. He should constantly hear the Bhagavatam, spoken by people who know the Bhagavatam, and he should constantly read so that he can have an understanding of the process that he's going to undergo. And then we can get out of this sprint cycle of burning out and then giving up and then thinking, okay, yeah, I'm not so burnt out. Let me try to sprint again. Because this, it only causes suffering, pulling this pendulum. And we often do this with austerities. We do this with Ekadashi. Yes, no water, no sleep, Prabhus. No water, no sleep. Okay, I'm not going to eat sweets anymore, ever. Many brahmacharis, at some point or other, they take this vow that, all right, it's time to be a serious bhakta. No more sweets. No more things that taste good. No more salt. When I came to the Harinam Ashram, I saw the prasadam and I thought, wow, this khichdi looks so good. And they made that sabji. It looks wonderful. The Harinam Ashram is in New York, where I served for 3 years. There was no salt. One devotee had convinced all the cooks there that salt was poisonous and it was really, really bad for brahmacharis and because it's sense gratification. And so for 2 months, there was no salt in anything. Luckily, they didn't ban salt from the house, so we just went and got the salt shaker. And, you know, the salt shaker then took extreme prominence on the table. But they didn't cook with salt. It's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous, this idea of austerity. And what happens? You pull the pendulum. No salt, no salt, no sweets. No, no this, no that, no, no, no. And the only thing you're thinking is no. And then your mind, it can't handle it. You can't handle this idea that, okay, my whole life is based around no. And you break. And then you go and you eat 25 cookies. Or you quadruple salt whatever you eat. Or you eat four bowls because you haven't had satisfaction in 2 months. So then you just eat and eat and eat, and your body just quadruple salt whatever you eat. Or you eat four bowls because you haven't had satisfaction in 2 months. So then you just eat and eat and eat, and your body just, your mind just craves that thing that you were rejecting. So our process is different. Our process is to take something wonderful and then understand that, wow, I was enjoying something inferior. I was enjoying something that wasn't really worth it. To not eat as a Gaudiya Vaishnava means that my sadhana has become so wonderful that I don't want to interrupt it to go take a break to maintain my body. And until we get to that point, there's really no point in trying to beat the body up and trying to go through all of these austerities, because then what happens? You lose the ability to even focus. Because then you're only thinking, how many of us have done a Nirjala Ekadashi? And all you think about is eating or drinking the whole day. Like, yes, I'm gonna be austere today, and I'm gonna do it. You know, this is gonna make Krishna happy. That for the next 24 hours of my life, I'm only gonna think about water. Actually, what will make Krishna happy is if for the next 24 hours of our life we think about Him, which is the purpose of Ekadashi. And if it's so ecstatic, if you're with a devotee who's speaking, you're doing really amazing kirtan, and you can also avoid water because, you know, the mood is there and you're being encouraged and your senses are active in remembering Krishna, then that's okay. But if we just sit down and not drink water, and then we're chanting japa and we're just, water, food, oh man, they made Ekadashi puris. They never make Ekadashi puris. Oh man. If we're thinking like that, it's not really going to do anything. It's not, there's not so much benefit there. So austerities for us, they mean I'm tasting something wonderful and I don't want to taste anything inferior anymore. When we're not on that platform, we just do what is necessary, which is more difficult in a sense, to find that balance where I can take things in a moderate way so that I can keep going. But this is actually sustainable, finding a balance in our life, finding a way that this is conducive for my practice. Okay, I like sweets, so I don't have one every meal. And I don't have 10 of them when I eat them. But here you go, mind. You take a little sweet and let's go chant Hare Krishna. We bargain with the mind like this. Actually, Krishna says in the 11th canto, Chandramali Maharaj, he shared this with us at the, I think, his final presentation. There's a verse where Krishna says, the highest form of mental control is to regard the mind. And he says it's like a horse. I don't know if any of you have rode horses. I've done it once. It's pretty scary. I can't imagine riding a horse that isn't broken. But when you want to break a horse, if you're a horseback rider, you have to understand a horse is about 15 times as strong as you are. If it's a weak horse, they're really, really strong. So you don't just put the thing on its face and then just crank on the, what's it called? The bridle. You don't just crank on the reins. Because what that does, it digs into his lip and it hurts. And so, if you do it right, the horse is like, okay, yeah, I get it, let's stop. But if he's not broken, and you just crank on that rein, then that horse is going to get pissed off. And he's going to say, hey, dude, you're digging in my lip. And he's going to throw you off and stomp you. So this is the mind. We're dealing with a very, very powerful thing that in many cases is much more powerful than us. And if we make it angry, then we're going to lose the battle. I'm sure all of us have been through that, where against our wishes, against our will, we're doing exactly what we know we're not supposed to do. We're doing exactly what we don't want to do anymore. We've fallen into something, whether it's eating, whether it's any type of vice. This is generally because those reins, we try to pull them so hard, and then the mind says, enough with you. I'm done with this. I'm not gonna deal with this. So Krishna says, an expert horseman, he chooses his battles. The horse wants to run this way. Okay, I'm still on your back. You run that way for a little while. And then the horse becomes a little pacified because he doesn't feel like he's being controlled and locked down. And then you can say, well, why don't we go this way for now? Let's go over here. And then he may listen. And through the process of doing this, breaking off, coming back. Breaking off, coming back. Choosing your battles, becoming expert at dealing with the mind. Becoming expert at dealing with your senses. The mind eventually becomes broken and the horse comes under control. So this is the way the bhakti yogi does with Krishna consciousness. He says, okay, you want to eat a sweet? Eat a sweet, but we're going to go read the Bhagavatam afterwards. We chant 16 rounds now. This is what we do. Okay, you know, you want this or you want that? I don't really want this, but take a little and let's keep going. Keep going, keep going, keep going. As I said, this is nishta. This is the understanding that, okay, I have to do whatever I can to make sure that I keep doing this process. I keep going. I keep being engaged in bhakti. So these were some thoughts. It's 8:25. If there are any questions, comments, or corrections, please. This was a little bit rushed. I heard last night that I would give class, and then when I read this verse, I thought, oh man, it's difficult. How will I expand on this? So please forgive me if it's been dry at all. Acharya, you have something? If there's nothing, Hari Shyam.
I just have an appreciation. When I heard the verse and the purport, I didn't really know which direction you were going to take the class in. So I particularly appreciated what came out. Yeah, especially this idea. I think what you were really hitting on is our fruitive mentality. Mm. That we have the tendency to pay through our austerities and then await the reward that comes at the end, you know. So yes. The best thing about Ekadashi is breaking fast. For instance, you know, it's like,
no.
You know, or like, the best thing about chanting japa is when it's over. Or
oh, that's a big one, you know. You know, I remember feeling that. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but just, yes. Yeah. At that 16 round, maybe it was like a year and a half in, and I like chanted my rounds, I thought, I'm done. Right. And then I thought, oh my God, that's not
it. Chanting to finish, as Michael Marsh says. But I was also thinking how one very pernicious way in which this mentality afflicts us is thinking that, oh, I've been around now for a few years, so now I deserve the respect of others. Mm. And I deserve the recognition of others. Why? Because, Prabhu, I've been serving here for 15 years. Did you not know that? Like, I've been washing pots before you even joined the movement. Like, come on, Prabhu. Like, this mentality of, like, I've done something for Krishna, so therefore now I deserve something back is so dangerous. Because, like you pointed out so nicely, the goal of bhakti is something else. It's not that we do bhakti so we get something else in return. As Jajanath often puts it, bhakti for bhakti's sake. I chant Krishna's name because that's what I do, you know. Even I heard to do bhakti for purification is also not the highest standard, yeah, you know. To do bhakti because I want to be purified of my anarthas is also not the highest understanding. I do bhakti because that's what pleases the Lord and I want a relationship with Krishna. Yes. That's why I come to the morning program. And, you know, that's why I do everything. That's why I serve. And my question is, so I had that appreciation. My question was, sometimes as like, you know, you want to help younger devotees kind of maintain sadhana, you know, but it's a very uncomfortable situation because I never feel good about going up to a devotee and saying, Prabhu, why don't you come to the morning program? Prabhu, why don't you chant more rounds? Why don't you do your reading? Mm-hmm. Because I wonder if by telling someone to do bhakti, will it really have the result that it's supposed to have? If someone doesn't want that relationship with Krishna and you tell them, Prabhu, why don't you come to the morning program? Why don't you chant? Why don't you, you know, if they don't want that relationship with Krishna and they do it because you're telling them, you know, and they say they do it because it's like, you know, people are telling them to do it. Mm. Does it have any benefit? Or is it better if someone doesn't have that natural propensity, like, you know, to want to do bhakti, that you just, okay, when your time comes, you'll just do it on your own? I don't know. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you have any comment on that?
I always have a comment because I'm an asinine guy who likes to answer questions. But one thing that I can think of is it's a matter of situation also. If somebody comes and they're under your care, you know, they're in the temple, they need the help, then it's actually a form of mercy to help them and show them, because many people, they need that stability because they can't conjure it up themselves. And on an, in an internal way, they want that, but they're not able to do it because the mind is just beating them. They're losing this battle with the horse that they're riding. The horse is just completely, you know, every time they try way too hard, and then they lose. And so they really need the help, generally, of the people who have more experience to just keep them on the road, to keep them on the path. So I would say that it definitely doesn't have no benefit, you know, if someone is in a position of leadership to, and there's an art to it, you know, to gently coax the person, and even not so gently when it's required, because many people need that in the right way. They need to hear that, no, you're doing this wrong, and I care about you, and that's why I'm saying it, and it has to be done like this, you know? So I would say that's the first thing. Which again, it's a big art, because if you do it wrong, then the person just hates you. And then you actually make them not want to do it, not want to see you, not want to do the process, not want to be a part of the practice. Sadly, that's their own ego. It doesn't really have anything to do with you. And the only failure that's there is on the part of you not being able to communicate so expertly. But yeah, that's such a difficult thing, you know? You can't really be faulted for that. We really just kind of have to fall back on our intention and then pray that Krishna, please help me convey to this person that I do really want to help them. You know, I think that's, in my small experience with that matter, that's been the only thing that has helped me when I'm in that position, is to just really pray that, you know, I'm not such a subtle person. I'm not, you know, I'm a bit of a brute. Please help me convey to this person that I, what I'm saying, I care about them. And that's the only reason I'm saying it. I don't have any other reason to say it. If we're, the danger you see is when you see people who don't have any reason to be doing that, doing it. And then that kind of burns people in general and then makes them not want to take any authority. Because you see some bhakta running around the temple, or even not a bhakta, like you said, somebody who's 20 years in the movement. We see this, who obviously likes to tell people what to do. And likes to give the corrections, and likes to, it's there. You know, every one of us has run into that person at some point in our devotional lives, usually early on. That person who just likes to find the flaw in what I'm doing, and like, you shouldn't do like that, you shouldn't do like that, you should do like this, you should do like this. That person, they're going through their own thing. And, you know, that usually burns people. So one also has to go the extra mile to show that that's not who I am. That's not what I want to do here. And I'm only doing this because I see that nobody else is going to do it for you. And it's what I needed when I was younger, you know, or when I first started. It's what I needed. So if we act from this platform, then I think Krishna will do this yogakshemam, bahamyam, carry what we lack. You know, preserve what we have. And other than that, yeah.
Thank you. That was nice. I'll just add one last small thing. I remember the story that I once heard about Jayadvaita Maharaj. It's really sweet. If anyone who doesn't know who Jayadvaita Maharaj is, he's like, how would you describe Jayadvaita Maharaj in one line?
Sadhu.
Sadhu, yeah, complete sadhu. Very precise, concise, extreme sadhu-like person. Anyways, wonderful sannyasi, very heavy. And so one time one devotee went to Jayadvaita Maharaj and was saying, like, in this mood of, oh Maharaj, you know, when we were young, we did so much for the movement, and we gave our lives, and we collected so much money, and we gave it to the temples, and in this spirit of, like, you know, like, what did we get in return, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
So he was saying like this, like, we gave our life, and Jayadvaita Maharaj just kind of like just picked up his hand and said, now give the rest.
Sadhu. Sadhu, that's it. I remember hearing this.
Just give the rest.
I remember hearing this, and it was infuriating to me when I first started. That they told me that Krishna doesn't see what you're giving him. He sees what you're holding behind your back. And I thought, that's not fair, you know. I'm trying to give so much. You know, you're only going to judge me based on this. But actually, that's mercy. That's mercy. The sadhus, Krishna, our guru, they're always going to show us that no, I'm sorry, but this isn't it yet. You're on your way, but this isn't it yet. You're not aiming at the right thing. That devotee that has been around for 10, 5, 15, 20, 25 years, and they're reaping the benefit of being able to order people around, that's a sad place to be. Because there's such a beautiful thing that's right in front of them. This book is so full of really wonderful things. And things that are, Krishna's just waiting to sweep us into the most amazing existence that we could ever, that we can't imagine. Not even that we could ever imagine, that we can't imagine. It literally has to be experienced. And we're gonna forsake that for the sake of being the guy in the temple or in the office or in the whatever, being able to tell people what to do. All of these really, really, really miserly things. So Krishna has to show us that no, this isn't it. Guru has to show us this isn't it. So offer the rest, like Jayadvaita Maharaj said.
Kind of balance it out, because for many people it is their service to tell people what to do.
Required.
So it's required. So it's not that what Josh is criticizing is the idea that people who are older and tell people what to do. That's not the point, you know, because you need people to tell people what to do. That happens to be my service, unfortunately or fortunately. But it's more the idea of, like, enjoying that sense
of life. Exactly, that's what I said.
You know, I'm senior and now I can tell you what to do, and kind of not so much thinking about the other person as a devotee or having their own Krishna consciousness, right? But having a sense of control or power over somebody who's younger than you, because stemming from the fact that one thinks, I've been around for so many more years, so therefore I can, you know, control you.
Yeah, it's coming from this.
That's what's being addressed here, not the idea that if someone is older and giving us guidance or directions, that's not good. That's very good. We need that, actually. We really need that. So, and we should seek that. We should seek guidance from authorities and elders and people who are wiser than us.
Yes.
That's very good, actually. But basically it's a point for us. We shouldn't think, like right now, you know, like if you're a younger devotee, you shouldn't look at the older devotee and think, wait till I get there, then I'll start commanding all the young bhaktas, you know. So one shouldn't think like that, and those who are like a little bit older shouldn't look at the sannyasis and think, wait till I become a sannyasi so I can get the maha plate and I can tell everyone what I don't like about the temple, you know. So that's wrong. That's the mentality that's being, just wanted to make that distinction, you know, so people don't walk away thinking, yeah, nobody likes managers.
if you're thinking like he's saying, then one nice aphorism for you, be careful what you wish for. If you're thinking, just wait until I can command the bhaktas, you just wait. Okay, we'll wait for that, and you'll see. It's not fun. It's not what you want. And that's the characteristic of a real leader, is that they don't enjoy that. Therefore, they carry it out as a service. You know, they carry it out as a service, and then they'll be inspiring, because you'll see that actually they enjoy doing real things. They enjoy, that's the mark of a leader. Look at Vaisheshika Prabhu. You know, I've seen there are choice times for Vaisheshika Prabhu, who is such a wonderful devotee, such a wonderful Vaishnava. He has to be heavy with people, usually on the sides, and you usually hear this story, because it's he doesn't enjoy doing it, he doesn't put it on a stage. But he's got to be heavy with people, but even the people he's heavy with, his disciples, whoever, they're not affected by that, because they see he's just absorbed in Krishna consciousness. He's fully absorbed in his desire to be Krishna conscious. So, like that. This is the mark of a real leader. Anyway, if there's anything else from anybody, and if not, we'll stop. Granthiraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Just off the record, guys, actually, the moral of my class was that we should...